have been in the area of, or started the area, and this is our third study, I believe, in the area of soteriology, or the doctrine of salvation. And we've come down to the part whereby we started last week with the problem that exists in salvation, and we made that in form of putting man over on one side and God on the other, and noted that in the problem of providing salvation, here is what God is up against. Number one, God has the problem of how can he communicate salvation to man because of the sin problem. Sin demands punishment, and it creates a barrier. How will he deal with that? The second barrier to God giving us blessing is his own character. God can never act in disharmony with what he is. God is perfectly holy, perfectly righteous, and perfectly just. Now, going up from the bottom, if God is just, what must he do to sin? He's got to punish it. Therefore, there's the problem of his character that keeps him from giving blessing. Since he's righteous, that means he can't be satisfied with anything other than righteousness. If he cannot be satisfied with anything other than righteousness, and we can't give it, then there's a problem. What is the problem? God has got to find a way to communicate blessing and not violate his own character. Then the third aspect of the barrier that exists to blessing or in salvation, or the problem of salvation, rests with us. Number one, our actions. We have sinned. Second, our nature. Romans 6:23. For the wages of the sin nature is death. Since we possess a sin nature, that's a problem. We have a family problem. As in Adam, which is the way we are born, all die. So we have a problem of being connected to the wrong family. Then we have the problem of condition, and the problem of condition is that man is dead in sins, and also he is the enemy of God. Now, the doctrines we have are just about to pick up, and we'll get started with tonight, is when God handled the problem sinward, we call that redemption. Solving the sin problem or the barrier sinward is called redemption. Solving the problem of God's character or solving the problem Godward is the doctrine of propitiation. And settling the problem of the barrier manward is called in the Bible reconciliation. So that each one of those things, we have been redeemed, deals with the sin aspect. God has provided in the death of his Son propitiation or satisfaction. That settles the Godward aspect of the problem. Reconciliation solves the manward aspect of the problem. And we'll get into at least the redemption part tonight. Now, remember, we also picked up last week in our study the fact that there had to be a method for doing this. How is God going to remove the sin barrier? And the method, remember, is wrapped up in the one word, substitution. And substitution simply means God has worked out a way whereby he can take the place of the sinner and communicate blessing. And that's where we stopped last week. We pointed out that substitution is the one method. It's the method by which God brings redemption, propitiation, and reconciliation. And under the method of being substitution, we pointed out that substitution is taught in several different ways. First of all, it is taught in Old Testament passages. And we spent almost all of our last study with Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is often called the Psalm of the Cross. And the only way you can express explain what occurred when Christ said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The broken fellowship between God the Father and God the Son, the only way you can explain it is God the Father was wrong, God the Son was wrong, and of course both of those are not possible explanations, so the only thing remains is that God the Son was forsaken by his Father because he was being a substitute for us. the second passage, and we'll not spend a lot of time with it, but we ought to have it down on a key passage as far as the Old Testament teaching on substitution, is Isaiah 53, and let's simply look at verses 4 through 6. 53, 4 through 6. In chapter 53 and verse 4, you have two completely opposite views of the work of Christ on the cross. In chapter 53 and verse 4, notice the text begins with the word surely. And if you would look the word surely up in a Hebrew lexicon, the word surely is listed this way. Surely is called an affirmative particle. An affirmative particle. An affirmative particle is simply a little word that is designed to affirm something in a strong way. For example, if you wanted to say, I am going to town, you could do so. But, at least in Hebrew, if you wanted to affirm that very strongly, you could put an affirmative particle on the front, and what it is going to say is that what I am going to say, I want to affirm in a very strong way. King James has felt the best way to do that is to put surely. So notice the way it reads. First of all, let's read it without the word surely, and notice he simply makes an affirmative statement, which is as follows. Verse 4, He has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Now that in itself explains plenty and says plenty. He has borne our griefs, He has carried our sorrows. But notice the author is not satisfied with that because he's afraid that we're going to miss the force of those words. So he says, let's attach on the front an affirmative particle. And the affirmative particle, again, King James says, surely, I think it'd be better to come across in English with something like this, beyond all doubt, or by all means, or definitely, He has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. And notice in the statement how closely you've got the idea of substitution. He has borne our griefs. Notice, He took what was ours. What is that? Substitution. And He has carried our sorrows. He took what was ours. What is that? That's the doctrine of substitution. Now notice, in the latter part of verse 4, you've got a completely contradictory view. The first half of verse 4, 53:4a, is God's view of the cross. And God's view is the cross was a substitution. Now notice in the latter part of verse 4, or 4b, that we look at it in a different way, because verse 4 says, yet we. In other words, the yet we introduces a contrast. What is stated in the first half of the verse is not what we thought in the second half. And the second half reads, yet, in contrast to being a substitution, we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. And so the last half is that as man looked at Christ on the cross, he looked at Christ as suffering for his own sins. Or you could simply put, the latter part is man's view. Man's view is non-substitutionary. God's view was substitutionary. And again, I think you can see the difference in the first half. First half, He took our grief. He took our sorrow. God's view, substitutionary death. Man's view, He was stricken, He was smitten of God, He was afflicted. But where's the substitution? All it does is said, yes, He suffered. But it does not say He suffered as a substitute. Can you see that difference in the two halves of the verses? The latter part is very objective. He was stricken. Why? Notice, no answer. He was smitten of God. Why? No answer. He was afflicted. Why? No answer. But what's the answer in the first half? The answer of the first half, it was our grief for which He was stricken and our sin for which He was bruised. so that you have the contrast. Then in the fifth, we might put down, by the way, just a couple of non-substitutionary views of the cross. And I'll put them down as they're often taught. One is to treat the cross under what is sometimes called the martyr theory. Now, both of these will be non-substitutionary views. In other words, they have truth in them, but they do not see the central part of the cross as being a substitution for sin. The martyr theory simply says this: Christ died for the truth that he held. Christ died as a martyr for truth. And of course, this always becomes eloquent. He held to the truth. He held what he taught until the end, and he died for what he taught. Now, you can't deny that that is true. There is a definite sense in which he died for the truth that he believed. That is not the heart of the cross, however. The heart of the cross is a substitutionary death. The other one is often called the moral influence theory. And the moral influence theory simply means Christ died to give us a challenge and an example. Christ died to give us an example and challenge. Now remember, that is not untrue. It just isn't the heart of the cross. Can you think of a passage that shows the truth that is involved in this idea? Remember over in 1 Peter, it talks about how he suffered, he went like a lamb, and so forth. He did not open his mouth. And then it says we are to follow in his steps. So that his death was definitely an example for suffering believers. But that is not the heart of the cross. So neither one of these are totally wrong. They just miss the main issue, is the whole point. And they bring out and say that though these things are true, that this is the explanation of the cross. And neither one of those will explain the cross adequately. Only substitution explains it adequately. All right, looking at 53 verse 5. Again, notice the strong emphasis on substitution. Verse 5, he was wounded for our transgressions. He for our. I wish you'd kind of see the way this is set up in the Hebrew. The way it's set up in the Hebrew, the words he and our are set throughout this passage in juxtaposition so that you get he and then right next to it, our. So that you get the force of substitution by them being so close together so that you would have he our griefs bore, he our sins took. And by putting those two words just butted up against one another, you've got the idea of substitution very clearly. But notice again, continuing in verse 5, he was bruised for our transgressions. Notice his suffering was due to his being a substitute. He was bruised for our transgression, iniquities rather. And the chastisement that procures our peace was on him. And with his stripes we are healed. And so forth, even down verse 6, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So again, substitution is underscored by two key Old Testament passages, Psalm 22 and Isaiah chapter 53. Now, that's not the only way that substitution is taught in the Old Testament. The second way is that substitution was taught by Old Testament sacrifices. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 1. And under the Old Testament sacrifices, let's put down the steps of sacrifice. The steps taken any time you had an Old Testament sacrifice made. and we'll divide that into two parts. The steps that are made, first of all, on the part of the offerer. The offerer's responsibility, first of all. Chapter 1, verse 2. Speak to the children of Israel and say unto them, if any man of you bring an offering of unto the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the cattle, even of the herd, and of the flock. So notice the first responsibility of an offerer was presentation of the offering. First step, presentation of the offering in verse 2. Second, down in verse 4, it says, he, and the he refers to the offerer, shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering. So notice the second responsibility after he presented the offering was identification with the offering. Identification with the offering in verse 4. He put his hand on the head of it. And then third, and in verse 5, it says he, that's the offerer, shall kill the bullock. So, third is the slaying of the offering. Now again, this would all be vividly imprinted on a person's mind, because if you can picture yourself as an Israelite and you have sinned, and God is teaching how he can be approached. And he says, I'm going to do it by asking you to go through a literal activity. And the activity is going to be the offering of a sacrifice. And you would go out and you would pick from the flock a sheep or bullock or something of that sort without blemish. So you have now made your selection and you then present it at the altar. When you present it at the altar, you then put your hand on the head of the bullock or on the hand of the lamb. So this is done in a literal way. Then the third step is that you, the offerer, take the knife, and of course the usual method would be to just to cut the jugular vein of the animal. So if you can, in your own mind, just go through the little routine. You have sinned. You want fellowship with God. If there's going to be fellowship with God, then somehow the barrier between you and God has to be dissipated. And God says, let me give you a picture, an object lesson of how to do it. Bring the animal, present it at the right place, put your hand on its head, take the knife, and kill it. And then, following this, you have the steps on the part of the priest. And he had to do certain things. Verse 5 says, he, the offerer, shall kill the bullock before the Lord, and the priest, Aaron's son, shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood round about on the altar that is before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. So notice the first step on the part of the priest is the, I'm going to put spatter, spattering of the blood. And the reason I use the word spatter rather than what our King James has as sprinkle is that sprinkle just implies sprinkle. And it wasn't done that way. They took the hyssop, which was a plant that was bushy at the end. And they, much like, think of it much in terms of a paintbrush. And they would dip the hyssop or the paintbrush into the blood. And then, as the altar was here, they would spatter it over the altar, just like picking up a paintbrush. And I don't know, I've always wanted to do that. Is it? Get a can of paint, take a paintbrush and just like that. Maybe, I don't know why, I won't do that. But this is what they did with the blood. They took it and they spattered it all over the sides and the top of the altar. So there is the first step. And then the second, down in verse 7, the sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar and lay the wood on the fire. So step 2 was the preparation of the altar. Leviticus 1:7, and then the third is in verse 9. Its inwards and its legs shall he wash, this is speaking of the priest, in water, and the priest shall burn all on the altar to be a sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet savor to the Lord. So then you have the final burning of the sacrifice. All right, now there basically are your steps. Now, what did this accomplish? Let's put down this, number two, the accomplishment of this activity. What did it do? Chapter 1, verse 3. It says, if his offering be a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own voluntary will. Now, if you're looking at an American Standard Version, you don't have that phrase that says, he shall offer it of his own voluntary will, do you? I don't believe. You shouldn't, because the words of his own voluntary will, the only way I know to say this honestly is that that just is not the way the Hebrew translates. The words of his own voluntary will are something like this in the Hebrew, to make a covering for him. So that verse 3 reads, he shall offer it to make an atonement for him at the door of the congregation before the Lord. Someone read real loud American Standard verse 3, will you? All right, that he may be accepted before the Lord. Notice the idea of substitution that is involved in that. You've got verse 4 in King James, of course, makes it clear. He shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it, and probably this is the part to underline, shall be accepted for him. Get that? It for him. To make an atonement for him. What is the accomplishment? Substitution. Or what are the words? It for him. In other words, there was a substitution involved, and it's taught by Old Testament sacrifices. Now, not only do Old Testament sacrifices teach that, but when you come to the New Testament, you have a New Testament teaching about substitution. And in the New Testament, the vehicle is not by means of an animal sacrifice or something of that sort. In the New Testament, it is by use of certain words or certain prepositions. Substitution is taught in the New Testament by certain prepositions. For that, let's turn to the New Testament book. The first preposition that is used in the New Testament to teach substitution is huper, H-U-P-E-R, or like that in Greek. Preposition is huper. The meaning of huper, if you would look it up in a lexicon, is on behalf of. On behalf of. Look, for example, at Romans 5:8. Romans 5:8. But God commends his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And the word for is the one that is important, because the word for is the translation of the preposition huper, meaning on behalf of, so that verse 8 would translate, Christ died on behalf of us. So notice you have the idea of substitution, for or on the behalf of us. Look at 1 Peter 3:18. 1 Peter 3:18. And in 1 Peter 3:18, you again have the word for as a translation of the word huper, meaning on behalf of. Substitution. Verse 18. For Christ also hath once suffered on behalf of sins, the just on behalf of the unjust, that he might bring us to God. And again, you have the idea of substitution again. Galatians 3:13. Galatians 3:13. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us. And again, the idea of for, who pair on behalf of us. So this occurs, and I'm simply giving you three passages, of which there are many, many, many passages like that, and they will usually use simply the word for, which is a pretty good translation, but again, remember, it's a preposition meaning on behalf of. There is a second word used in the New Testament to express substitution, and that's the word anti, anti. This is a little bit stronger, because if you look it up in a Greek lexicon, it would call it this. It would call it the preposition of direct substitution. The preposition of direct substitution. And the idea of direct substitution means that there is one thing exchanged directly for another. And therefore, the idea of anti is the idea of instead of. Now again, on behalf of, instead of are very similar, but instead of is the idea. Anti would be the word that would be used in football or basketball, or that would be used of a pinch hitter. You have substituted directly one position and player for another taking his exact and direct place as a tackle or whatever might be involved. Look at Matthew chapter 20, for example. Matthew 20 and verse 28. It says in verse 28, "Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom unto many." Instead of many. Preposition of direct substitution on the part of the Lord. It's the same one that's used in that passage where it says, if your son asks you a loaf of bread, will you in return give him a, and I forget whether it's the viper or the snake or the stone, right? He asks bread, will you give him four, if he asks for bread, will you give him for that a stone? And it uses the word anti. In other words, he asked for bread and you made a direct substitution. The direct substitution was you gave him a stone. In that particular passage. All of this teaches the idea and the concept of substitution. So, going back to what we started with tonight, putting up again the idea that there is a problem that exists, and the problem that exists is the problem of God's own character, the problem of man, and the problem of sin, and what is the method for eliminating this total barrier so that he can communicate blessing. And that only one single method will be to work out a means whereby God himself becomes a substitute and takes the wrath in the place of man. Now, we need to put down one other thing before we leave substitution. And that is, if we are going to have a substitute, does the substitute have any requirements? What are the requirements of a substitute? Now let's look at the first one. Since man has sinned, the wages of such sin is death. So that the requirement is simply going to be that if the justice of God demands a death penalty, you've come up against your first major problem. How can God be a substitute? If he's going to be a substitute, what's he going to have to do? He's going to have to take the penalty of sin. What's the penalty of sin? the penalty of sin is death. And what's the problem? Go clear back to when we started studying through systematic theology. What is one of God's attributes? God is eternal. Now, how is God going to, even if the plan sounds neat, let's be a substitute, how's he going to do it? You say, well, God is going to die. Well, how can God die? God's eternal. So that the first requirement for substitution is going to be incarnation. And the incarnation simply means God taking a human... I'm sorry, that is not the way we define it. The incarnation simply means God joining the human race by taking a body so that he could die. So that to bring about substitution, you have to have requirement number one, incarnation. The second thing you obviously have to have, if God is going to be a substitute, you have to have, number two, volition. In other words, there has to be someone who says, I am willing to be the substitute. You can look at it and say, well, God could be a substitute by taking a human body. What if he doesn't want to? If he doesn't want to, you can't have any substitution. And that is the area of volition. Look at John 10, where that's emphasized. John 10. Volition, I'll put in parentheses next to this. There has to be willingness to substitute on the divine part. And John 10 is a passage that emphasizes that very strongly. John 10, verse 17 says, therefore doth my Father love me, that I lay down my life. Notice the volitionary aspect of it. I lay down my life that I might take it again. Verse 18, no man takes it from me. Now that is extremely important, because it means this: Christ did not bleed to death on a cross. I've heard even supposedly Orthodox people that supposedly know something of the word come up with some of the most stupid cross dishonoring statements that you can ever imagine. Occasionally you get some nitwit that will say Christ died on the cross of a broken heart. And I challenge him and say he is a blasphemer, because that belittles the work of the cross. He did not die of a broken heart. The entire text says that the death of Christ on the cross was volitional. He's the only person that ever died that way. No one ever gave his life for somebody else in the same sense that Christ did, because nobody else can ever, of their own free will, die for somebody else, can you? Stop and think. Can you, of your own free will, die for somebody? No way. You say, well, yes, you can. No, you can't. If you walk in the front room and someone has a gun cocked in the ear of your best friend, and the man says, somebody's going to die, and you say, I will take his place. Okay, that's volition so far, right? And the guy says, okay, you get out, and he sticks the gun in your ear. All volition so far, right? He pulls the trigger, and the hammer hasn't hit the bullet yet, or the primer, yeah, the little thing in the middle, the primer, yet. It's still a fraction of an inch away. You can still duck if you want to. So you're still hanging in there with volition. But the bullet enters your head and passes through. Now, I don't know exactly at what point, but at one point between the time the bullet touched the first hair on your head and exited the other side, you lost all volition. You lost it before you died, because you couldn't say, as the bullet just pierces the skin, I quit. No, it's too late. Because ultimately you will die of what? You will die of a bullet wound. So that you went volitionally most of the way, almost all of the way, but there was a point at which you could not change your mind. With Christ, there was always the option, though he never took it, there was always the option to change his mind. You say, well, there was not. When the Romans had him chained, how would he get away? Remember, he emphasizes he could change his mind at any moment. How did he do so? Remember the little reminder he gave them to show that you guys aren't going to handcuff me, drag me, take me, crucify me anywhere except of my own volition. Remember he mentioned that he could have 12 legions of angels at hand immediately. And what is he saying? This death is all volition. It is all done completely on a willing and a total willing basis. And he's the only one that ever died that way. And there's your emphasis. In verse 18, no man taketh it from me. He was not murdered, killed, bled to death, had a broken heart, though that all may have been true. That was not the essence of the cross. I lay it down of myself, and then again, notice he underscores that. I have the power to lay it down, and I have the power to take it again. This commandment I have received of my Father. So that we have his meeting the requirement of taking a human body. You have his meeting the requirement of perfect volition, complete willingness all the way. John 10:17-18. A third element enters in to being a substitute. And we can express that in one word. In order to be a substitute, there had to be a separation. Or let's put it this way. He could not be a substitute if he was part of the problem. He could not be part of the problem. In other words, if he was a sinner, how could he substitute for somebody else? Turn for that to Hebrews 7:26. Hebrews 7:26. Now recall, he is going to become a substitute for sinners, as we've already seen in many passages. At the same time, he is separate from the problem. Verse 26, for such a high priest was appropriate for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and made higher than the heavens, who does not need daily, as those high priests, speaking of the ones in the Old Testament, to offer up sacrifice, first for his own sins, and then for those of the people. For this he did once when he offered up himself. So notice the idea is that he was totally separate from the problem. He had no sins of his own to atone for. Therefore, you've got a perfect substitute. Incarnation, requirement met. Complete volition or willingness to substitute, completely met. Separation from the problem, completely met. Hebrews 6:27-28. Or was that 26 and 27? Okay, that fairly well then covers the idea that God's method is going to be a method of substitution. Now, let's take, coming down the barrier part, the sin aspect, the satisfaction of God's character aspect of the problem, and now how substitution will satisfy the third aspect of the problem of man. So the solution of, number one, the sin word aspect, or redemption. The first important thing to remember about the word redemption is that though there are several words used in the Bible for redeem, that just fix in your mind initially that the idea of redemption, basically, right at the heart, is simply a word that means to buy, to purchase. Now, it does not mean to repurchase. The story that's often told, and I remember evangelists telling it, is that here's a little boy that has a boat. And I forget the details of the story, but somehow the boat gets hocked. And he goes by every day and sees the boat that was once his in the window. And he begins to save money, and depending on how you want to tell the story, he saves enough money finally that he's able to go back and he buys his own boat back again. It was once his, it got hocked, and he made the money and bought it back again. To buy back again, that is redemption. Good story, but incorrect. That is not what the word redemption means. It's a common word that's used even in the New Testament for just buying something, like what you would do if you go to the grocery store for the making of a purchase. So, in outlining redemption, the first thing we ought to do is note, and again we can do this briefly because we've really had it in the barrier we've studied, the condition that requires it. The condition that requires it is expressed in Romans 6, verse 17. And that is, well, let's begin with that passage. Romans 6, 17 is the condition that demands it, the backdrop for redemption. Romans 6, 17 talks about the pre-redeemed state of the people to whom he is writing. And it says, "But God be thanked that whereas you were the servants or slaves of sin or the sin nature, you have obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which is delivered to you, being then made free from sin." So notice the condition that demands it is called slavery. Why do we need to be purchased? Because we are by nature slaves. That's the background or condition. Keeping in mind, in terms of what slavery meant in those days, are two basic ideas. Basically, a slave had no legal rights. And if you read enough about slavery in the first century, you know that a doulos, or a slave, did not have legal rights. Not if he was in a slave class. Which basically is saying he didn't have any volition of his own. The second thing that is important is he could not resign. The only way he could get out of slavery was, one, die, or he could run away. And remember, we have a whole book written in the New Testament, it's a little book, but the book of Philemon is all about a runaway slave. He just took off. To what degree slaves ran away, I don't know. To what degree they ran away in the first century, I would imagine that a good amount of slaves, if they could possibly manage it, would run off. The problem is, of course, they would run off, and still being in the slave class, they would probably become the slave of someone else. But you remember Philemon, you have the runaway slave. So he had no legal rights. He could not resign. Basically, the only way you get out of your slavery is by means of death. Now, there were some modifications of that. But basically, that is a general picture. The other thing that we need to bring into the picture in order to understand the background for redemption is this. Both goods and people were property in the first century. Both goods and people were property in the first century. Now that is very hard for us to think in those terms, but it's also very important to think in those terms because that's the background for redemption. Today, the only thing we have as property legally would be goods. You cannot legally say that I own five people. I mean, you may be a maneuverer, and you'd be able to manipulate people to where you can get them to do what you want them to do. But legally, if they chose not to do so, you would have no legal claim to say that, look, I demanded this of so-and-so, and they did not do it, and get any court help on the basis that, well, look, he is your property. Where's your bill of sale? You know? And it'd be impossible. So we've got to learn to think in terms of goods were property and people were property. The best exhibition of the idea of the goods and people being property would usually be when a Roman general had gone out and had a tremendous victory. And when he had had a tremendous victory, he did not just defeat a town, but they took booty. And among it was slaves, and among it was people. It would be just like someone coming down, a Roman general marching into Kansas City and loading up his trucks with all kinds of property and goods, and also tying together a long chain of people. And when he came in victory to town, of course, the rich people were tremendously excited because we understand that he just conquered a town down here in Africa that has this particular kind of goods. And when the general comes into town, usually leading the whole group, he will bring it into Rome and we'll have an opportunity to have a big old auction. And on the auction block would be goods and ivory and gold and silver and all types of things. And also on the block would be some of the finest slaves you have ever seen from wherever place you happen to find them. And they'd simply be put on a block, and you'd come down, and if you had a need for a few extra slaves, you'd come down with a handful of bills and say, I bid $25 for that one over there, and someone else would bid, and whoever would outbid would get a slave, and you would have legal rights to that particular person. And of course the coffers of Rome would be filled again, and that's basically the way they did it. So Paul takes in the New Testament those conditions, and again, can you imagine them in your mind? He takes those conditions and transfers them and says, look, this is where every man is. And the person that buys you off the block is God. And that is called redemption. So, let's follow then with a definition of what we mean by redemption. And what we'll do is simply list the involvements, the four involvements or four ideas that you always ought to have when you think of the word redeem. First of all, the first concept is that, and I'll just use an R for redemption to be brief, redemption always involves purchase. Whenever you have redemption, it always involves purchase. Not repurchase. It always involves purchase. Look, for example, at 1 Peter 1:18. 1 Peter 1:18. And if you'll notice in reading the verse that it simply contains, and if you'll just take the word redeem and read the word purchase, you'll not have all of the ideas, because there are three others, or two others rather, but you'll have the basic idea of the verse. Verse 18 reads, "For as much as you know that you were not purchased." And purchase is just a basic idea. You were not purchased with corruptible things like silver and gold from your vain manner of life and so forth, but, repeating the idea of purchase, you were purchased with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. 1 Peter 1:18. Redemption always entails the idea of purchase. Now, just logically, whenever you recognize that redemption involves purchase, what other idea has to go with it? Just logically. You have to have price. Redemption always involves, connected with it, price. Simply because you cannot have purchase without price. Now notice, in the same passage that we're looking at in 1 Peter 1:18, he puts what the price cannot be. Forasmuch as you know you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver and gold. Why, in the verse, will silver and gold not be an adequate price? What is the quality that silver and gold bears? All right, it is perishable. It is corruptible. In other words, our sin problem, redemption, cannot be accomplished by anything that is perishable. Well, what is the price? Well, verse 19 spells out what the price was. It was the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. Look also at Acts 20, verse 28. Acts 20, verse 28. Redemption always involves purchase. It always involves price. Chapter 20 and verse 28, "Take heed, therefore, unto yourselves and to all the flock over which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to feed the church of God, which he has purchased," and then notice the purchase price, "with his own blood." In other words, it was the death of Christ that was the purchase price or the tag involved on redemption. The third thing that is always involved in redemption is that redemption involves freedom. Redemption involves freedom. Galatians 3:13. Just a note on Greek words here. There are several for redeem. Probably the most common is the word agorazo. Agorazo comes from the noun agora, and agora meant marketplace. So that in any town or city, you had a place where buying and selling was done. The place where buying and selling was done, as over against the residential area, was called the agora. I guess shopping center would be roughly equivalent to it, because we have certain centers where purchases are made, and then you have the residential area. And in any town, you had the agora. The agora was the business place, the place where you did the purchasing or the buying. So that was the noun for it. If you would say, "I'm going to the agora," that simply meant you were going down to a marketplace. Now, you might go down there and window shop. However, if you went down there with the idea of buying something, then you change the word agora to the activity, and when you change it to the activity, to buy something in the marketplace is agorazo, and it means I purchase or I buy. Now, Galatians 3:13 is a little bit different word. It takes the word agorazo, which means to buy or to purchase, and it strengthens the word by putting the word ek on the front. From the preposition ek, which again you've heard 18 million times, meaning out of. So the idea was not merely to purchase, but to purchase and remove it from, or the idea of freedom. And that's what he stresses in 3:13. Christ has redeemed, ex agorazo, us, from the curse of the law. What's the method of redemption? Notice the next phrase. Being made a curse for us. What's the method? Substitution. Redemption is effected by substitution. Reconciliation by substitution. Propitiation by substitution. Substitution is the divine method for providing for salvation. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. So notice the idea is there is involved a curse that was placed on us, but where is it now? We are free from the curse of the law. So purchase, price, freedom is always involved. So that really, purchase emphasizes the act of redemption. Price is the method. It's by a payment that it is done. And freedom emphasizes the results of redemption. Now, let's put down a C, and it'll be our last point for the evening. And that is, the New Testament emphasizes the extent of redemption. And in emphasizing the extent of redemption, here's what I mean. Let me put up our barrier here again. When God redeemed man, we often Well, this is almost Christianese, isn't it? We say Christ died to save our souls. And that is totally incorrect. And the reason it is incorrect is that that does not recognize the extent of redemption. Man is made up of a body and a soul and a spirit. Redemption touches all three. The extent of redemption is not just to save our souls. The extent of redemption is to save our soul, spirit, and body. So that you can say in all honesty, and we'll look at a passage that says it in just a moment, that you can look at your left arm, and since we know from, well, we haven't been there, well, from the doctrine of sin, we should have picked it up, that man is affected physically, materially, by sin. And it is perfectly correct to say, and we really perhaps ought to emphasize it more, it is perfectly correct to say, as a testimony, I am very thankful tonight that Christ died for my right arm. That is true. He died for your right arm, left arm, right leg, left leg, liver, kidney, heart, lungs, brain, whatever extent it exists, ears, nose, hair, more or less, depending on the case. Extent of redemption. Now, first of all, look at Romans 3:24. Romans 3:24. The extent of redemption is it reaches the total man, body, soul, and spirit. It reaches total man, body, soul, and spirit. Now, first of all, this is expressed by a word that we're about to look at. It is expressed by a word. One of the verbs we mentioned for to redeem or to purchase is agorazo. There is another one, and that is the word lutrao. Lutrao also means to purchase or redeem. And in Romans 3:24, we read this. Being justified freely by His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Now here is a word that is, remember the word agorazo, and when you want to put zip to it, they put the ek on the front. Well, this passage, Romans 3:24, the word redemption is the word lutrosis, with the word APO on the front. Apolutrosis. I found one translation that had a good translation of this. The idea of apolutrosis. Lutrosis means to redeem. Apo emphasizes the thoroughness. Put a preposition on the front to intensify a word. So it's, how would you put it? Being justified freely by His grace through His complete redemption. Or I saw one translation put it this way. Being justified freely through the, or by the, and this was all in dashes, through and through redemption. The emphasis is the idea of totality. The complete redemption or complete purchase. Now, we need to note under that the part we often tend to exclude, that this includes our body. It includes our body. Romans 8:23. Romans 8:23. Christ died not only to provide redemption for the soul and spirit, but also for the body. Romans 8:23 reads, and not only they, but ourselves also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, that is, the redemption of our body. And therefore, you have an inclusion of body, soul, and spirit involved on the part of man. One last passage. Look at Ephesians 1:14. Notice that the provision of redemption is total and complete, and yet here we sit tonight in bodies that have been redeemed, but they're also corrupting. So that we know that certain aspects of redemption are in the future, and what is the guarantee of redemption? The guarantee of total redemption. The guarantee of total redemption is expressed in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 14, where it says of the Holy Spirit, He is the down payment of our inheritance until the redemption of the purchased possession. So notice that though we are redeemed now, there is a future aspect of it, and the guarantee is Ephesians 1:14. The down payment has been made. The guarantee is the presence of the Holy Spirit. So that with redemption, you then have the first aspect of the barrier between God and man dealt with. And that is a redemption has dealt with and substituted for sin, so that sin as a barrier is removed. Now, next Tuesday evening, we'll look at probably one of the most neglected and yet one of the most fantastic. In fact, I think it'll probably take us two Tuesdays to get through it. Will be the fact of how God managed to satisfy His righteousness and satisfy His justice, and that will be propitiation, and it will involve going into the tabernacle in the Old Testament and looking at the lid on the mercy seat, and it will entail looking at how Christ fulfilled that aspect and show that God, as far as what He can demand from me, has been satisfied completely and totally by the fact that I had a substitute who provided adequate payment, an adequate price, an adequate righteousness, and He did it in my place, doctrine of substitution. Father, we're thankful tonight for Your Word, and for the wisdom that brought out this kind of salvation that we possess. We recognize, as we look at the problem that is entailed of our sin and God's character and our own condition, that there would be nothing in the world that we can do for ourselves. And we're so thankful that before we were ever born, that You undertook to provide for us a perfect salvation and erase all of the barriers to blessing. And may we recognize tonight, as we sit here as believers, that there is absolutely no barrier to blessing whatsoever, aside from our refusal to appropriate. And may we recognize that it is also Satan's avowed purpose that we will forget that salvation is something to be appropriated. And we will forget, and we will begin to think that blessing, even in the Christian life, is merited, and therefore fall into the deadly trap of legalism and miss all of the blessing and all of the greatness that has been involved in removing the barrier between God and ourselves through the death of Your Son, Jesus Christ, for which we give You thanks tonight in His name. Amen.